millions of miles away in time.
We will be talking about penalty methods, probably about our pensions.
Yes. So I'm going to talk today about analysis of a penalty method for solving a guarantee pricing problem for a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit. This is joint work with one of my students. Okay, so let's consider the following problem. This is pretty common these days that companies and governments are trying to move people off of defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans. In other words, you put money into some kind of a retirement account, which you've got some kind of tax advantage, and then you invest it, and whatever happens, happens, and that's what you get when you retire, right? Whoop. Oh, full screen, yeah. Good time. Well, I was expecting you to the full screen. Okay, if I can find the thing here, view. Control L. All right, we have an expert here. There we go. Okay, full screen. Okay, so the idea again is to move people off these defined benefit plans. And so now we're a lot of people, the majority of people now in sort of the developed world, really have these retirement accounts they have to manage themselves. And the standard advice given to people, because people are living longer, is of course that you have to invest in the stock market. Otherwise, if you invest in risk-free assets, you're going to run out of money before you die, and that would be bad, right? So the standard advice is you have to invest in the stock market. And you consider this is actually quite risky, because think of a following case. The investor has this money in this retirement account. They retire, and they begin to make withdrawals from this account in order to live on. And immediately you can see that there's a big problem here. The outcomes are going to be very different in the cases if the first few years after retirement the market goes down and you withdraw money compared to the case of, well, suppose the contrary happens, the market goes up at first and then down and you withdraw money. These two situations here result in very different outcomes for the investor, right? If you left the money in for the whole time, it wouldn't matter whether the market first goes down, then up, or up and then down. But if you have to pull money out and the market goes down, you'll never make that back up again. Okay? So in this situation now, you are exposed to risk in terms of the order of the random returns, not just the total return, right? There's an extra level of risk involved in investing in risky assets when you retire. The same thing happens, by the way, if you look at endowments for universities, as they are discovering these days, right? There's this problem, the fact that you're exposed to risk through the order of random returns, which somehow nobody ever takes this into account. Okay? So the bottom line here is that losses in the early years of retirement can be devastating in the long run, and early bad returns can cause complete depletion of the account, of the retirement account, which is obviously sort of a bad thing. Okay, so here's a typical guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit example. These are very simple. I'm just going to look at a very simple case here. They come with all kinds of complications, but let's just look at a very simple case. Suppose an investor pays $100 to an insurance company, which is invested in a risky asset. And just we're going to fix some notation here. We'll denote the amount in there's two accounts here, two sub-accounts. And the amount in the risky sub-account, the amount that's actually invested in the stock market, I'll call W, and that's initially set at $100. At the same time, you also get a virtual guarantee account. This is a bookkeeping entry, and that's also set, we'll denote that by A, and that's also set at $100, the initial amount you give the insurance company. Okay, so we'll suppose the contract runs for 10 years, and the contract withdrawal rate is specified at $10 per year. Okay, so at the end of each year, then, the investor can choose to withdraw up to, you can choose to withdraw up to $10, and I'll call that, say, gamma half, so you can choose to withdraw between $0 and $10, and suppose the amount you withdraw is gamma half. Then what happens is that the amount invested in the stock market and the amount in the virtual account are reduced on a dollar-for-dollar basis, right? So after you withdraw, W nu is reduced by what you had before minus gamma hat, and the amount in this bookkeeping entry is also reduced by the amount you withdrew. Okay? Note, of course, you got this max of W minus gamma and 0 here, which is important. So this continues on for 10 years, right? And so at the end of 10 years, the investor can withdraw anything left. You can take the max of W and A. Okay? So everybody kind of got that straight there. And note that the investor can do, can you withdraw cash as long as A is bigger than 0, as long as the bookkeeping entry is bigger than 0, even if W hits 0. Okay? So this is your protection, right? So even if the market crashes down to 0, right? You can still withdraw as long as you have something non-zero in this bookkeeping entry. And that's the protection that you get on this. Okay, so why is this a useful thing? Well, the investor can participate in market gains, right? If the market goes up, you can participate in those gains, but you still have a guaranteed cash flow. You get that $10 per year if you choose to take that out, regardless of what happens. Okay? And the important thing, again, is this insulates people in these pension plans from losses in the early years of retirement. Okay? So this gives you this guaranteed cash flow, regardless of what happens in the market, which is, of course, a very useful kind of thing to have, right? Well, how does this work? The protection is paid for by deducting a yearly fee, which I'll denote by ADA, from the amount in the risky account W each year. So the insurance companies aren't doing this for nothing, right? They're going to collect a fee, and the fee comes off as a proportional fee from the amount invested in the stock market. Okay, so W is the amount of the risky asset, and A is this bookkeeping entry. Okay? This is called a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, and it has many possible variants in practice. There's a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit, which sometimes just goes on until you die, right? And there's all kinds of other bells and whistles associated with. You can have these things where if you don't withdraw for a couple of years, you get to increase the amount you can withdraw, and all kinds of other complicated features. Okay, so this is the simplest possible case I'm going to look at here, just to give you some idea of what goes on. In practice, there's many other complicated contractual features in these things. So I'm going to look at this very simple, basic, guaranteed minimal withdrawal benefit as being a sort of a typical example of these kind of insurance contracts. And well, up until recently anyway, most variable annuities show, this is a type of variable annuity, this is called. In Canada, we have a similar product, which is called segregated funds, which were very popular too. Most variable annuities sold in North America have some kind of market guarantee, right, to protect people against this kind of bad things happening. And again, in Canada, we have this thing called a segregated fund, which is a similar kind of idea. Okay? So again, I would say, unlike a lot of sort of derivative products sold by banks, this actually is a socially useful product, right? You can actually see why retail investors would want to purchase such a thing. This is insurance against bad things happening when you know you have to invest in the risky asset after you retire, right? It's actually a perfectly reasonable thing that reasonable people would want to buy. They're buying some kind of insurance, okay? Okay, so let's go and kind of pose this a little bit more mathematically here. The investor can choose, I'll add a little bit more of the interesting contractual features here. The investor can choose to withdraw up to a specified contract rate, which I'll call G sub R, without penalty. And usually a penalty, as it's called kappa here, some fraction bigger than zero, right, is charged for withdrawals above that contract rate. Okay, so the insurance company is going to allow you to withdraw up to this amount per year, and if you withdraw larger than that amount, they charge some penalty on that. Okay, so let's let gamma be the rate of withdrawal selected by the holder. Then the rate of actual cash received by the holder of this contract is the following. If I withdraw between zero less than gamma less than this contract rate, I'll actually get the amount of cash that I withdrew. And if I withdraw bigger than this rate, then I'm going to get some penalty charge. And this is what I'm going to get. I won't get the full amount, gamma. I'll be paying some penalty, kappa usually being the order of 10% on the amount above the withdrawal rate. Again, I'm going to assume that kappa is constant here, but again, in real, at least for this simple example, again, in real contracts, this typically starts off at some high level and decays after 5 or 6 years down to zero, right? So there's usually a high penalty in the initial time, initial few years of this contract, and it decays down to a smaller, often zero after 6 or 7 years. Okay, but we'll just keep things constant here, simple, and we'll assume that, or we'll let kappa be constant here. Okay, so again, you get to withdraw up to this rate, some kind of rate specified in this contract. You withdraw above that rate, then you pay 10% penalty. You want to think about it as a specific example. All right, let's let S denote the value of the risky asset, and we're going to assume again in this simple case here that we basically follow geometric Brownian motion. So the asset follows the usual risk-neutral process there. The risk-neutral process followed by W, this is the amount actually in the investment account, is then given by this expression here, right? So this looks almost the same, except of course I'm subtracting off the fee, right? So the fee is being subtracted every year. that's kind of like a dividend in some cases, in some sense. So you can think of a fee coming off here. That's why the drift is reduced by eta, the amount on the risky asset. There's the Brownian term, and there's the, well, this extra term here represents the withdrawals, right? You can write it kind of this way. Otherwise, if I withdraw a certain amount, then I'm going to reduce the virtual account, the bookkeeping entry, which will also, of course, reduce this W by the same dollar amount, except, of course, the W is zero if W equals zero, right? Because you don't withdraw anything more from the risky account if you're down to zero, right? Okay? Again, remember the eta here is the fee paid for the guarantee, and A is this virtual bookkeeping entry. So W is the amount actually invested in the market, and A, again, is this virtual bookkeeping entry. Okay, so we're going to determine the no arbitrage value of this contract. In particular, what you want to do is determine the fee, the no arbitrage fee that the insurance company should be charging for this contract. That's the pricing problem, in some sense. Okay? So let's let V be the no arbitrage value of this contract. And this is a function, it's a two-dimensional problem here. It's a function of W, the amount invested in the risky asset, and the amount A, the bookkeeping entry. This A is a path-dependent variable, obviously. And tau time running backwards. We're going to, as usual, solve from the payoff time down to today to get the value of the option contract. Of course, you think of this as it's a no arbitrage value of the contract. It also, of course, gives you the cost of hedging, right? That's really what we're interested in. The insurance company should be interested in this. At the contract expiry, tau equals zero. That's T equals big T, of course, forward time. The amount I actually get is usually given by this expression here. It's the max of W and A, and often sometimes there's a penalty charge. But again, remember in practice, this will be zero by that expiry time anyway. So typically, the real payoff is just max of W and A. Okay, again, if you haven't withdrawn anything, you obviously get that amount, the maximum of whatever is actually in the risky account and whatever is left over in your virtual guarantee account. Okay. So it turns out that it's optimal to withdraw at the rate gamma, the following two possibilities. Either gamma is in zero and GR, or gamma is infinite. Okay, and when gamma is infinite, that means you instantaneously withdraw a finite amount. Okay. Yep. I'm jumping ahead here, okay? So I'm for simplicity here, and I'm going to write down the PDE and then write. Okay. I'm jumping over the derivation of this.
Also, where's the gamma
differential equation? It appears in that DA term. You can think of it that way. Okay? Yeah, it's buried in there. We're going to see the final thing in all its glory in a minute. Okay, so this leads us to a singular control problem here. So let's let L of V be this sort of Black-Scholes type operator here. This is the kind of evolution of W, if you like, due to the evolution of W, and there's the drift term there, again, because the drift term is reduced by this V discounting term. I'm going to let F of V be this differential operator here. And then, as shown in this paper by Dai et al. From 2008, the no arbitrage value of this guarantee is given by the solution of this HJB variational inequality here. So it's the min of this thing and that thing equals zero. Okay, so I'm going to now just give you a little sort of intuition on, this looks pretty mysterious, you know, how did that come about? Well, let's sort of derive this kind of in an informal kind of way to give us some intuition as to where that variational inequality comes from. And in fact, it's very useful here that we're going to do this informal approach here because this is going to lead us to develop a numerical scheme, right? This is why its intuition is nice here. It immediately leads to a numerical scheme. And then we can eventually show that the numerical scheme we get converges to that original HJB equation. Okay? So there's a reason here to go through this. So let's consider the optimal control problem with a large but finite withdrawal rate. Okay? So I'm going to say, well, you can withdraw at any rate up to 1 over epsilon in size. Okay, epsilon is some small number. And let's let H of gamma be this expression here, and you can think of it this way, that H of gamma, well, for example, if I'm withdrawing at less than the contract rate, then H of gamma represents, well, there's a cash flow I get from the withdrawal, and this term here, it represents what happens to the contract after I withdraw gamma, right? So there's two parts of this expression. That's what the cash flow I get, and that's kind of the reduction in the value of the contract after I withdraw gamma. And then there's a similar expression when gamma is bigger than this contract rate, and I have to kind of adjust it due to the fact that I pay this penalty. Okay? So again, the first term represents the actual cash flow I get, and the second term here represents what happens to the guarantee after I withdraw the contract after I withdraw. Then in fact, I can write the control problem down for a bounded bounded maximum withdrawal rate in the following way. It's V tau equals LV, and max gamma is in between 0 and 1 over epsilon of that H of gamma. Okay, so, well, this is kind of a piecewise linear function here in terms of gamma. So the maximum occurs at gamma is 0, GR, or 1 over epsilon. Do a little bit of algebra, and you get based on that result there, you get this expression here. So I just take this expression here and note that the maximum appears at those three points. Then I can rewrite this expression this way. V tau plus LV is max of this thing here. Okay, a little bit of algebra gives me that. Okay, again, this is all just assuming that I can withdraw at some finite but large rate. Okay, well, again, I'll rearrange that expression on the previous slide, and I get that this is equivalent, the algebraic equivalent to this expression, the min of this thing and this thing equals 0. So what does that mean? That means that this expression here is greater than or equal to 0. This expression here is greater than or equal to 0, and at least one of them must be equal to 0. Right? So, well, this thing is greater than or equal to 0. So I can kind of pull it out for a minute and say, okay, well, that's greater than or equal to 0. Multiply it through by epsilon. Epsilon's positive. I can do that. That's greater than or equal to 0. Stuff it back into the min expression. I get this thing here. Okay? This is a bunch of algebraic steps. And now let epsilon go to 0, right? Epsilon, remember, 1 over epsilon is the maximum rate of withdrawal, right? So by letting epsilon go to 0, I'm allowing the withdrawal rate to become infinite. I'm allowing the possibility of withdrawing instantaneously a finite amount. So I let epsilon go to 0, this term disappears, and lo and behold, I end up back with this HJB equation I started with. Okay? So there's a simple way, intuitive way of deriving this final expression here. Okay? So I start off again assuming that the withdrawal rate was large but finite, went through the argument, and I just took the limit as that withdrawal rate goes to infinity. Okay? So that's why I end up with this so-called singular control problem. Okay, so the basic idea of the penalty method, this is developed by Guy and Kwok about 3 or 4 years ago. Min dies at Singapore and Kwok's in Hong Kong. Using the same kind of argument, they say, okay, well, let's just keep epsilon finite, and we can rewrite the expression before in sort of control form, if you like. So I can write that as V tau equals L of V, usual kind of Black-Scholes parabolic operator here. And it's a max. I'm going to introduce two control variables, phi and psi. And phi and psi can each only have the variable, the possibility they're each, phi is either 0 or 1, and psi is either 0 or 1. And I'm going to maximize this expression here over all possible values of phi and psi, with the proviso that only one of phi or psi can be non-zero. Okay, so there's only a couple of possibilities here. If I maximize this expression here, subject to this set of possible values for phi and psi, that's equivalent to what I had on the previous slide there, with all the maxes and mins and so on. Okay? Idea is kind of trivially simple. We're going to discretize equation number 6. We're going to let epsilon go to 0. We're going to choose epsilon to be proportional to the mesh size H. Right? So epsilon goes to 0 as the mesh and time steps go to 0. And what we're going to show here is that the discrete version of 6 is consistent when the viscosity slumps with the singular control problem. And we're going to be able to prove that this very simple idea here actually does converge to the viscosity solution of the HJB equation. Okay. Now, this is it's really nice here because this is absolutely trivial to program. You can even ask fourth-year students to program. So this is very simple to program. That's why it's a very nice, simple idea, and it's very intuitive, and you can rigorously show this will converge to the viscosity solution of the HJB equation. And I'm going to remind you, by the way, that if you've spent some time solving HJB equations, this is a non-trivial issue about convergence to the correct solution. It's often the case that you will produce, you can generate some numerical scheme that looks quite reasonable, and you can do some tests, and it looks like it converges to something, but it's actually the wrong solution. Okay, I've got, I have several examples where you can do something that looks very reasonable, You can converge, it looks like it converges, you let H go to zero, it looks like it's converging to something, and it's the wrong solution. Okay, so this issue of making sure your scheme does in fact converge to the viscosity solution is something you actually have to be careful about, right? This is not just some kind of theoretical issue here, this is actually a very practical issue. So I'm going to pay some attention here to make sure that this scheme, which seems very intuitive and simple, actually does converge to the right solution. Okay, some previous work here. So Molesky and Salisbury, who's sitting in the back over there, I think they're probably the first people to actually write down the equation for this pricing problem. Again, it's kind of surprising, isn't it, that these kind of products have been around for well over 10 or 15 years, and nobody seems to have actually written down the equation for this until 4 years ago, right? Kind of said something about the insurance industry, I guess. I think they were really probably the first people to pose this GMWD problem as a singular control problem. Again, Dai and Kwok and Zhang, they published a paper in 2008, and they really proposed this penalty method. They just sort of went through this intuitive analysis here and showed the results without really an analysis showing that this actually converged, which is what the point of this paper is. And then together with one of my students, we actually solved the impulse control formulation of this problem. You can equivalently solve this with epsilon difference in the solution with an impulse control formulation. And so we do that in about 2008. There's another guy, I forgot to list here, an actuary from Georgia State, Daniel Bauer. He's also solved some similar kind of problems too as well, using more of a Fourier time stepping approach. Okay, but actually there's not a whole lot of literature on these methods, on pricing these kind of contracts, even though they're extremely widely used in North America. Also a lot of interest now in Europe. I know that in fact some German insurance companies are either required to by law or very interested in offering these kind of products. Right? So again, from a societal point of view, you can see why retail customers would in fact want to buy such things. Okay, so let's do a little bit of analysis here. So the original GMWB problem is posed on some infinite domain. So as usual, when we're doing something computational, we localize the domain somehow. Right? So it's posed on the problem W can go from 0 to infinity. A, this is the bookkeeping entry, goes from 0 to what I call little w or omega 0. Omega 0 is the amount that you initially invest in this to give the insurance company. Right? So it never gets bigger. It can only get smaller because you're withdrawing. Right? You can't add more. Well, actually, some of the contracts do actually allow you to add more, but we're going to ignore that complication here. So the range of possible values of A is from 0 to W omega 0. Of course, time goes from 0 to big T. And for computational purposes, we're going to localize this domain here from 0 to W max, right, and apply an asymptotic boundary condition. I won't go into the details here. Again, you can see that in the guide paper there, what those boundary conditions are. Okay, I'm going to make the following assumption here, that the localized GMWB singular control problem satisfies a strong comparison result, which essentially means that a unique continuous viscosity solution exists. You can't find any literature which precisely addresses the singular control formulation of this precisely, so I'm making this assumption. We know, by the way, that in Seidel, which I gather is some relation to you, your son. Anyway, it is shown that an impulse control formulation problem of the GMWB pricing problem does in fact satisfy a strong comparison principle. Okay. However, again, there doesn't exactly seem to be a precise exact proof of this for the singular control formulation of this problem. Okay. So in fact, since these problems are somehow equivalent, one would naturally assume it's true for the singular control problem too, but I can't really find a proof of that. Okay, so I'm going to make that assumption that there's a unique continuous viscosity solution and then proceed. So we're going to discretize the problem in kind of the usual way. We're going to have to define a set of nodes from W0 to WI max, some finite value for W, large but finite, right? And then we're going to discretize in the A direction. A is the bookkeeping entry and W is the actual risky asset again. Remember that? And we'll let V sub IJ superscript N be the discrete approximation to the value of the contract, so V, I, J, N is V at W, I, A, J, and tau, N, usual kind of notation. I'm going to define a vector of nodal values along lines of constant A, J. This is a two-dimensional problem, so you can think of looking at a line of constant A sub J. I'm going to call that V, J, N, So the value of this contract along one particular line of A is given by VJN. That's a sort of vector which has these kind of components here. Okay? Okay, so I'm going to use fully implicit time stepping here. And I'm going to use forward, backward, or central differencing on the VW term. This will turn out to be a useful thing to do. I'm going to use central differencing as much as possible, yet still retain what's called a positive coefficient scheme. If you come from the probabilistic point of view, this means that the probabilities, if you like, are positive, right? Or non-negative. Okay? Now, there's a little trick here, which almost nobody seems to use, but it's trivial, again, to code. And that is to use central differencing as much as possible, yet still retain a positive coefficient scheme. This is a very simple two lines in your program. And yet, as we'll see, actually does, in fact, improve convergence. Most people just use some kind of simple upwinding, forward-backward differencing, but you don't have to do that all the time. I mean, sometimes you do, but you don't have to do it all the time. So as much as possible, you want to use central differencing because it's the higher-order method. So we use that. The downside of doing this, by the way, is the interesting is that the local objective function becomes a discontinuous function of the control in general, but it actually doesn't cause you any problems, surprisingly. Okay, so we're going to use this here, the central differencing as much as possible idea. Okay, so we can write down we've discretized the problem now. We've got a set of equations to solve, a set of nonlinear equations. You can write them down this way here. So again, this Vj here represents the solution along each line of constant Aj. And you write this down as the identity matrix plus delta tau times some other matrix here and a bunch of other stuff here. The important thing to note here, by the way, this looks like a linear set of equations, but it's not, because M, P, and D are functions of the optimal controls, which in fact are functions of the unknown value, right? So this equation here that you have to solve along each line of constant J is in fact a nonlinear equation, set of equations, right? But you can write down this kind of matrix form if you remember that M is sort of a nonlinear matrix operator. Okay? Let's let F sub H be the discrete form of this differential operator here. The optimal controls phi and psi are just given by discretizing that max expression there. So phi and psi, which are functions of the unknown value, of course, are given by the thing which maximizes that expression. Okay, so you choose phi and psi. Phi and psi clearly depend on V, and V depends on phi and psi, and so on. So that's why it's a nonlinear set of equations. Okay? So again, this makes this equation nonlinear, quite highly nonlinear. The positive coefficient scheme, again, I'm not going to go into the details here. I'm just going to give you the bottom line. If I discretize this set of equations using a positive coefficient scheme, again, the intuition is that gives you positive probabilities or non-negative probabilities, if you like. This matrix M here is a script M matrix, or a script M matrix, or maximum matrix or Minkowski matrix has positive diagonals, negative or zero off diagonals, and is diagonally dominant. And if that's the case, then I plus this thing here, the inverse, is always strictly greater than or equal to zero. Okay, that's a very important property. Okay, and we use that in proving all the remaining results, basically. Okay, so if this is an M matrix here, then this property holds. So we're going to use a type of policy iteration to solve these nonlinear discretized equations. Okay, very standard kind of approach when you're doing control problems. And it's very simple to prove this result here. If a positive coefficient condition is satisfied, in other words, this is an M matrix, then the policy iteration converges to the unique solution of that set of nonlinear equations for any initial iterate. Okay, and this is a very standard approach. Again, it's detailed in this paper here, but the same thing that people have done for years. Basically, you just show the right-hand side, in some sense, is a non-negative quantity, and you have a bounded non-decreasing sequence, and therefore it converges. Okay? So it's quite simple to show that this iteration always converges. Okay? Again, you have to do this every time step, of course. So you want to make sure that it converges regardless of your initial guess for the solution. Okay, again, I'm going to go through here this prescription here that you need to check to make sure that your scheme converges to the Minkowski solution. I want to emphasize this again. This isn't some stuff you do just to write papers. This does actually cause problems. Right? You can ask me afterwards how I first got interested in this. It had to do with I was dealing with a graduate student, and we both got different answers to the problem. And a graduate student and a supervisor, if the graduate student gets a different answer, obviously the graduate student is wrong, right? Well, it turned out not to be the case. Anyway, so here are the things you have to show. The first thing you have to show is that the technique, the discretization is infinity norm stable. Okay. Again, this all follows from this positive coefficient condition. You can prove that the method is infinity norm stable. You just use some maximum analysis, a bit of induction, and do some algebra, and you get that result. That's pretty straightforward. Monotonicity. Here's the other condition you need to ensure. If the discretized scheme satisfies the positive coefficient scheme, it uses the positive coefficient scheme, then the discretization is unconditionally monotone, independent of the time step size, which is what you want. Okay? Again, you can just run through. There's some algebra to prove that. Again, you can go through the description here in this paper here. Describes how to do this in general. It's just an application of that general technique, in this case, to show this is monotone. So what is monotone, you may ask? Okay, what does that mean? Again, some intuition here. It's an algebraic condition, but let's get down to what does this really mean, right? What this means is that it really implies a discrete arbitrage inequality. It means that inequality of payoffs implies inequalities of the value at all earlier times before the payoff, okay? And the interesting thing is this is true regardless of the mesh size or time step size, not just some limit, okay? This is a discrete property of the discrete solution. They satisfy this arbitrage inequality regardless of the time step size and mesh size. That's what a monotone scheme implies. Okay? Of course, this is something you'd want to have true anyway, right? Makes good sense from a financial point of view. But this, you would like your discrete scheme to have this property, so we're just ensuring that that's true here. Okay. Consistency. Well, this is a little more exciting here. So basically, let's suppose there's some mesh parameter I'll call H. Traditionally, in numerical analysis, we always call it H, isn't it? Right? Somehow, we always call it H here. So H is the delta W max, the maximum grid spacing in the W direction is some constant times H. Maximum grid spacing in the A direction is some other constant times H, and so on. And I'm also going to let epsilon, remember that epsilon, that penalty parameter, also be proportional to H. And here's the consistency result. In the limit as H goes to zero, the numerical scheme is consistent in the viscosity sense with the singular control volume. This requires a bit of algebra here, but I'll refresh your memory about how this works. Viscosity solutions, you remember, are always defined in terms of smooth test functions, right? And consistency in the viscosity sense is very relaxed, right? You're not actually looking, the actual solution itself may not be differentiable. In fact, it's not in this problem. So you can't ask for something to be consistent in any kind of classical sense. But you can ask for consistency in this viscosity sense, which is always in reference with these smooth test problems, right? So you apply the differential operator to these smooth test problems, show something is true, and then you get this consistency. And it's very relaxed, very forgiving way of asking for consistency, okay? So, in fact, it's true. You go through, in fact, it's actually very simple because in some sense you go through the same steps we used in our informal derivation of this HJB equation. Only this time, we use finite difference approximations to the operators and smooth test functions, and then we just go through that the same steps, and we get this consistency result. Okay, so you go through the same kind of steps we went through the intuitive thing. This time, we just do it with finite difference operators and smooth test functions, and it all works quite nicely. Okay, all right. Okay, convergence. Provided that the GMWB singular control problem satisfies this strong comparison principle, and we use fully implicit time stepping with a positive coefficient discretization, then the penalty scheme converges to the unique continuous viscosity solution of the GMWB singular control problem, right? And, well, we satisfy everything we need, right? The scheme is monotone, consistent, and stable, and so, therefore, from the results in that paper, we know this converges. Okay? So, again, we got these things we have to check. We got to design our scheme to satisfy these properties, and then we know we're fine. Okay, we know for sure this method is going to converge to the right answer. Note, by the way, convergence is guaranteed only for any penalty term epsilon of the form epsilon times c, epsilon equals some constant times h. Right? So any penalty term which looks like this for any constant c, this will converge. In practice, of course, we want to choose c appropriately. Mike must have gone over time, right? I have some more time. Recall, The investor pays no extra upfront fee for entering into this contract, only the initial premium W0. The insurance company deducts an annual fee, ADA, from the balance of this risky account. So the problem then is to determine the correct fee to charge. Okay? So let's let V of ADA, WA, and tau be the value of the contract at WA and tau, given a yearly fee, ADA. So I'm parameterizing, sticking the fee into this sort of value here, if you like. I have to specify the fee before I know what the value is. Let's assume the investor pays initial premium W0 or omega 0 at T equals 0, which is, of course, tau equals big T. So then the objective now is to find the no arbitrage fee eta such that V of eta, omega 0, omega 0, and big T equals omega 0. Right? So the if I'm charging the correct fee, the amount, the contract should be exactly equal to what I give the insurance company at the start. Right? That's really what that means. So I want to find the fee eta such that this expression is true. Okay. Did I say something there about how I was going to do that? Yes. We do this by Newton iteration, right? So you can think if we're going to solve this by this is a big Newton iteration problem where the function I'm evaluating is the solution of this HJB equation. This turns out to be actually not too bad because, of course, you do the sensible thing. You start off with a coarse grid, find the eta on the coarse grid, take that as your initial starting value, go down a few levels. So on the finest grid, you only do 2 or 3 Newton iterations, so it's not actually that expensive. Penalty parameter. Okay, again, I'll remind you we obtain convergence if we have this penalty parameter is any constant times delta tau. Okay. However, we can kind of get it in some sort of financial reasoning here and give us an idea of where the correct order of magnitude here. Recall the maximum withdrawal rate from our sort of informal derivation is lambda, that's the maximum withdrawal rate, is 1 over epsilon, right? So if lambda, the withdrawal rate, is omega 0 over delta tau, what that means is that the entire guarantee amount can be withdrawn in one time step, right? That's the rate, then I multiply it by delta tau, then I can withdraw the whole thing, right? So effectively, if I choose lambda v equal to this is effectively an infinite rate. There's no, doesn't make any difference numerically to choose anything bigger than that, because I would take everything out in one time step. Okay, so remember that epsilon is 1 over lambda, right? So that suggests that a reasonable value for epsilon would be 1 over lambda, so that's going to be delta tau over omega 0 times some constant, right? So C star is now a dimensionless number less than 1. Okay, so now we have something which is right, that kind of gives us the right dimensionless number we want to have. We want to figure out what C star is. I'll remind you as well, of course, that when I went to that informal derivation, there's this extra term floating around here, epsilon times this thing. So this thing should disappear as epsilon goes to 0, right? So on a coarse grid, we would like to make this small. So maybe we should choose C star to be kind of small. So I'm going to choose C star to be 10 to the minus 2, but I'm going to go through some examples here to show you it actually doesn't really matter what you choose C star within about 8 orders of magnitude. But I'll just choose that for the time being here, give you some examples. So here's a 10-year contract, interest rate's 5%, maximum withdrawal rate is 10 per year, right? The withdrawal penalty is 10%. I'm going to use a couple different volatilities. One of the interesting ones I'm going to show you is the graph I'm going to show you is for 30%. Initial lump sum premium is $100, initial amount in the account balance is $100, and so on. Penalty parameter is 10 to the minus 2, that's my C star here, times delta tau over omega 0. Okay, I'm going to solve this problem in a sequence of grids, right, and check the convergence, right? I'm going to look at call these various levels here. So I start off with 117 nodes in W direction, 111A, 120 time steps. And as I go down here, I'm going to double the number of nodes and the number of time steps. Okay? The usual kind of thing to check convergence. So here is the here are some results for two different volatilities, 20 and 30%. I'm cheating here because I'm going to use the no arbitrage value, which I've already got by computing this offline, as it were. Okay, so the no arbitrage value, which I claim to be the correct no arbitrage value, is 0.01 for volatility of 20% and 0.03 for volatility of 30%. Of course, what should happen here is I refine this grid here. Since I've initially given you the insurance company $100, I should find that the no arbitrage value of this thing is $100 if I charge the correct fee. And lo and behold, of course, that's what I observe. As I refine the grid here, this will converge to precisely the initial value I give the insurance company, provided I charge that fee there. And similarly down here, I'm charging this fee here for volatility of 30%, and yes, indeed, it does converge to $100. A few other things here, number of iterations per time step. You can see it's 3 or 4, not a whole lot. Only 3 or 4 of these policy-type iterations are required per time step. This is a ratio of the differences between these values here. So by examining this ratio here, you can sort of estimate roughly what kind of order of convergence you're getting. You don't expect to get, these are not smooth problems, right? You don't expect to get nice convergence. So, well, you can see it's between somewhere between second and, first and second order here. These two columns here, this is the central differencing as much as possible column. This is the backward differencing only, which is kind of the more of the standard approach. And you can see that using the central differencing here as much as possible does in fact converge faster than $100 compared to this thing here. And there's a trivial change to your software here, right? So you should always be doing this, right? This is nonsense to ever do this all the time, right? For almost nothing, you get extra kind of rate of convergence, okay? Okay, again, the number of iterations per time step is pretty small. It does converge somewhere between first and second order rate. You may ask, right, how come we're getting almost second order convergence when, well, I'm doing two things here which are only first order. This seems kind of odd. It's kind of a fluke, right? This is not a general result. Fully implicit time stepping should only be first order, right? But it turns out for this problem that V tau tau is getting very small as I approach big T, so that fully implicit is almost exact, right? That's kind of lucky. In the infinite withdrawal rate regions, because the convective term, for those of you that come from PDE background, that's infinitely large, I have to use some kind of backward differencing there. Again, you would think, well, that's only first order correct. But now I got another lucky thing that happens here. The solution in these regions is almost linear in W and A. So first order differencing is almost exact, right? So this is just lucky, right, that we get almost second order convergence because we've got these all these lucky things happening. Okay, certainly not something you would expect in general. Okay, the penalty parameter, okay? So again, we choose some penalty parameter here when we're solving this problem. This will converge, I'll remind you, for any epsilon of constant times delta tau. We went through some financial reasoning to tell us that, well, epsilon of this kind of size is about the right thing to pick because if that's equal to 1, this is an infinite withdrawal rate. So we should choose C star less than or equal to 1. C star is some dimensionless number. We'd like to choose C star to be small, so convergence is rapid on coarse grids. I mean, eventually it'll converge regardless of what you choose, but in practice we want something that converges reasonably well on coarse grids. Well, if we choose C star to be ridiculously small, we're going to have some kind of precision problem, right? Obviously, you can't tell the difference between two numbers, the order of machine precision, so you don't want to make this thing ridiculously small. You won't be able to tell what one thing is less than the other thing, right? So how should we choose C star? Okay, people often don't like penalty methods for this reason. Well, there's some parameter you have to choose. How do I choose that thing? Okay, well, let's try a whole bunch, right? So here, value here at the finest grid, at level 5, which is 1,000,000 nodes or something like that. This is the value with no insurance fee, just to show something different here. So I'm assuming there's no insurance fee being charged. So of course, the value I'm going to get is bigger than my initial $100. I'm going to let this penalty parameter C star, because remember, everybody multiplies delta tau over W0. I'm going to choose this to be 1 or 10 to the 9. 10 to the minus 9, try everything in between, and just see what effect that has on the solution. And you can see it actually doesn't have a whole lot of effect, right? As we'd expect. It's going to converge no matter what you choose, right? You can see here that, well, if I choose anything between 10 to the minus 2 and about 10 to the minus 7, it only affects the 7th or 8th digit of this thing, so it doesn't really matter, right? So any choice between 10 to the minus 1 and 10 to the minus 7 works fine, okay? And that's well away from any kind of precision problems you're ever going to encounter. So it's certainly the case that, you know, if I want to solve this thing to 8 digits, which nobody's ever going to want to do, right, that choosing this parameter anywhere in that range is fine, right? So it's not really a big deal. And I can do this for this, get about 7 or 8 digits of accuracy, which of course is kind of ridiculous, but we're in numerical analysis here. We'd like to do stuff like this. Okay. Again, you can draw these nice pictures here. This is the most exciting thing about doing HJB equations. You can draw these control maps here and try to figure out what it means, you know. Like, you would never figure this out unless you knew what the answer was. And after you know what the answer is, then you can come up with some reason why this is the optimal strategy, right? So, in fact, so this is W in this direction, A in this direction. This is a control strategy at t equals 0 today. Okay. So basically what it says here is if I look to see what my W value is and my A value is, that tells me what I should do. Okay, optimally, find the holder of this thing. So if I'm over here, what happens is, this is a standard thing I happens over here, is if I'm sitting here, I withdraw to the edge of this boundary, right? I withdraw the, instantaneously withdraw an amount until I get hit that boundary there. And similarly over here, I withdraw a finite amount here until I hit this boundary here. Okay? And in this rate here, this region here, I withdraw at the contract rate. So I withdraw at the contract rate here. In these two regions here, I withdraw at a finite, instantaneously finite amount. And you can work out, if you ask my colleague Ken Venzel, he'll be able to explain to you exactly why you should do whatever you do in these two regions. Don't ask me, right? Okay? So something here, what happens is, well, if you're way out here, the guarantee doesn't have any value, so you should take your money out as soon as possible. And we want to try to minimize the amount of penalty you pay and so on. So it's kind of interesting. Interesting thing here is actually there's a region here which appears to be the case that although the value must be unique, the control is not unique, right? So in this region here, you withdraw either at rate G or nothing, and either are optimal, okay? It's kind of interesting. There's actually a region here where you can do either of those two things and they're optimal, okay? Okay, again, the fair fee here is about 0.03. Some practical result here, okay. So here are the kind of different values of these no arbitrage fee for different volatilities, so 15, 20, and 30% volatility, for example. So 15%, you get 70 basis points, 20, 140, and 30, 310 basis points. Okay, well, wait a minute now. Okay, what's the current volatility of the S&P 500, right? Well, probably bigger than 15%. Typical fees, at least until recently, were around 50 basis points. These guarantees. So immediately you got a problem here. First of all, I'm assuming, by the way, that all these fees are going to use for the hedging program. In fact, that's not the case. The big chunk of those fees goes to pay the sales force, right? I've used a very simple model for the. I've used geometric grounding and motion here. If you add jump processes or other contract features, you only get bigger value for this no arbitrage fee, right? So, in fact, anything reasonable here, you split up the sales fees, you add jump processes, you end up with something like this, you know, 300 basis points, 400 basis points, compared with typical fees of 50 basis points. Obviously, there's a problem, right? And it's quite clear that insurance companies are basically charging these fees based on marketing considerations and not worrying about hedging. Okay? Okay, a quick comparison with impulse control formulation. Again, you get essentially the same solution if you use an impulse control formulation of the problem. The impulse control formulation would look like this. Okay, so you got the same sort of Black-Scholes type operator here, the max term here. Now you got this impulse control term. Of course, you got this infinitesimal fixed cost here to make this well posed. Again, if you let C go to zero, you should get the same solution as you get from the singular control problem. Okay. If H is the mesh size parameter, then the complexity of the impulse control formulation is order H to the minus 4. You might think it should be H to the minus 3, but in fact, you get this extra power of H here. You have to do a linear search to solve the local optimization problem at each node. And you have to do that because you want to find the global maximum of some smooth test function to order H. And the only way to do that is to do a linear search to guarantee. And again, by the way, if you don't do that, you can construct examples where you converge to the wrong solution, okay? So you can't just use some sort of standard optimization thing to do this, because that'll only find the local maximum, not the global, okay? So the impulse control complexity is basically order H to the minus 4. This singular control problem has complexity order H to the minus 3, so that's a clear winner. However, the impulse control formulation is certainly more general. There are some contractual features which you cannot formulate as a singular control problem. You must formulate it as an impulse control problem. Okay? So only for very simple contracts can you formulate it as a singular control problem. But if you can, you definitely will have a technique which is much faster than the impulse control formulation using this approach. Okay, so that's a big advantage. Okay, to summarize then, this penalty method can be proven to converge to the solution of the singular control problem, which is, as I say, a non-trivial issue. A very important issue, which I'd like to emphasize that. The penalty method, the other thing which is really nice about this technique is this is trivial to implement. Right? This is very simple to implement. Okay? Anybody can implement this. Okay? This is not difficult to tell. Okay? Again, people have this thing about penalty methods. They don't like them because there's this arbitrary penalty factor. Well, it's not so arbitrary. Look at this problem. It's easy to estimate what the size should be. And it's really insensitive over almost 9 orders of magnitude to what that penalty parameter is, right? Okay, it's going to converge for any value, and you can pick a value from 1 to 10 to the minus 9 and pretty much get the same solution, which is good. Okay? Lower complexity than the impulse control formulation. But from a practical point of view, there will certainly be some cases where you cannot formulate the problem as a singular control problem. You have to solve the impulse control formulation. Just for amusement, you can start driving this penalty factor down. You can look at 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12. Well, once you get down to those kind of numbers, you do and see some kind of precision problem showing up. Okay? But this is not a problem of any practical concern, right? I mean, you can get 8 digits here without difficulty for a huge range of values of the penalty parameter. It's true that eventually you must have some precision problem, but it's not something of any practical concern. Okay? Practical result here, insurance companies are charging fees which are not covering their hedging costs. And this has actually come home to roost here in Canada. We had a large Canadian insurance company take a huge mark-to-market write-down because of these products, right? CEO, of course, claimed that, you know, this no arbitrage mark-to-market stuff was unnecessary and too pessimistic, right? Meanwhile, he retired with a $100 million bonus, right? And since then, the stock has crashed by about half, right? They cut the dividend and so on. Okay, so this is actually, again, this is a very simplified model of what these guys are doing. It's much more complicated what these guys are doing, but immediately you can see that it's way off what they're charging. Factors of 3, right? The other thing that people often, actuaries often come back and say, well, no consumer ever acts optimally, right? Well, again, you can take this into account. You can add a little actuarial model which says, okay, the probability of somebody exercising this guarantee is a function of how much you're in the money. And again, it doesn't reduce the fee that much. And I've gone way over my time. Thank you. Very kind of you.